from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harvard President Lawrence Summers sparked a national uproar late last week when he waded into the minefield of genetics and gender. The current shortage of elite female scientists, he reportedly said, might be due to innate differences between men and women. Should we consider, he asked in effect, whether top-tier math and science just might not be in women's DNA? His provocative question was put to a conference on diversifying America's science and engineering workforce to top academics from across the country, from Georgia Tech and Columbia, from the universities of Washington, Oklahoma, and Iowa. Now, the Harvard president has said he's sorry that he was misunderstood. But the impact of Summers' remarks is still resonating, and it has turned heads again to the question of nature, nurture, and the biological boundaries between men and women. Tonight on Point, women in the sciences and the struggle over genes and gender. You can join the conversation. In 2005, should we still be talking about gender differences and biological aptitude? Is this a fresh take on the latest research or a new spin on old prejudice? You can join tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight with the latest on the impact of Harvard President Lawrence Summers' statement. Joining me now in the studio is Audie Cornish, reporter for WBUR. She's been following the story. Audie, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom.
I should say right off the bat, in none of this are we directly quoting Larry Summers. Reportedly, the meeting was taped, but that tape has not been released, and we're told there's no transcript. So this is all relying on recollection and what Larry Summers has said since and what others are saying when they were there. But describe the setting for us. There's people from around the country. They're sitting at Harvard. Larry Summers stands up and says...
Well, ironically, the conversation was not taped because they said they didn't want the conversation misconstrued.
Oh, not even taped.
And
oh,
so,
because
well,
they didn't want it misconstrued. Okay.
Exactly. And so people were there taking notes. There is a tape, I think, that you're referring to that Summers' office does have. They are not releasing that, saying that it was a private sort of candid discussion.
Okay.
This was a working luncheon for the National Bureau of Economic Research. You know that President Summers is an economist. And as you said, this was a discussion about diversifying the ranks of the top academic ranks of science at universities across the country. And so he was there as a university president at a top school to discuss, well, what is going on here and what are people thinking about it? And right away, he said, I'm going to be provocative, and went on to give the remarks that have sparked such uproar.
He delivered on that promise.
He said many times throughout the speech, and the thing that's caused the most controversy was about this issue of citing research that girls and boys in their high school years of testing, often there's a difference in the numbers of boys. More boys are scoring higher
high
in
end.
Math and science mm-hmm. testing at mm-hmm. the very high end. And he said, well, let's look at this, because does this point to a possible innate difference that later on we're seeing reflected in the elite academic ranks?
That it's not all about socialization and the way girls or young women are treated or raised, but there may be something, essentially he's saying, inherited here.
Yes, and when someone questioned his remarks later on, he said, well, you know, the idea was there's some new research out there that shows maybe the entire problem is not just about socialization or discrimination. And that is when some people did get upset. There was one prominent researcher, Nancy Hopkins of MIT. She actually walked out of
the
talk.
We'll hear from her in a moment.
Yes, and many people spoke after, and that's sort of how this story leaked out. And in the aftermath, it's caused quite an uproar at the campus because they've already been dealing with a problem of tenure offers in the higher ranks.
At Harvard, just 4 to women out of 32 last year, and this is an issue right across the country.
Yes, just literally 2 months ago, some 50 professors went to Summers directly and said, we have a problem, specifically under your tenure. The number of tenure offers has dropped. And so for him to make these remarks in this context of what else was going on at the campus, some people thought was just inappropriate.
The uproar, not just local, but right around almost the world. I'm looking here at comments in London newspapers today and yesterday, mostly very critical. So it was someone saying this is rubbish. And of course, Larry Summers himself, Washington Post, reporting on this, saying he's earned a reputation for blunt, sometimes brutal comments in his in his, 3 years now.
He has, but his critics on campus were saying, you know, obviously the president of the university, specifically Harvard, obviously comments he's going to make are going to reverberate. And it was pretty naive of you to go out there and say what you did and not think it wasn't going to cause more than a ripple. And he has issued an apology, a formal letter in response to a group that sent him a message saying that, you know, he misjudged the impact of his role as a conference participant and that he actually apologized about any adverse impact that it would have on the work that's being done on his campus. And other people say, you know, it could have adverse impact on the work that's being done on other campus to make the math and sciences at the advanced levels more friendly towards women.
So the president saying he wants to build up the number of women on his faculty, but his critics saying, well, your remarks may just discourage the very people that you'd like to attract to math.
Exactly.
And
when I went on to the Harvard campus and sort of talked with students at random, the women I talked to outside the Cabot Science Center on the campus were saying, well, you know, is this what he thinks? Because this isn't helpful.
Does he think we're genetically
less
well disposed to be mathematicians and scientists?
Does he think this of women in the math and sciences? It's pretty discouraging, was a word I heard several times.
So there's kind of the proof in the pudding of the impact right there. But not everybody was critical. He had some economists saying, let's talk about this.
There were definitely, because the idea was this was a working luncheon. We're all here for discussion, and this is one hypothesis that he's drawn, and it's one hypothesis out of many that we're here to discuss. And some people thought that, you know, some of the reaction was a little bit knee-jerk. And there were quite a few people who didn't necessarily defend him but said, we are having a greater discussion here. We cannot rule out parts that you just don't like or parts that are taboo. That's not the job of a scholar.
And yet, once you get into this realm, things get very loaded in a big hurry. Artie Cornish, thanks for covering the story. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Artie Cornish, a reporter for WBUR. Earlier, I spoke with Nancy Hopkins, professor of biology, a leader in DNA research, co-chair of the Council on Faculty Diversity at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a member of the National Academy of Science. She was also at the conference when Harvard President Lawrence Summers made his remarks. Nancy Hopkins got up and left. I asked her at what point she felt angry enough to leave the room.
Well, when he gave particularly the second reason, most important reason of why he thinks that women don't make it to the top of professions, and that was aptitude. That was what really upset me so much. He had three reasons why he thinks women don't get to the top of professions, and he meant, you know.
And you mean science and engineering professions?
No, he really meant all. He said it's not just
really?
Science and engineering, it's really business and law, you know, it's all of them.
I see.
And so he was talking very broadly, and I think this was part of the problem of what upset me. So then he said, first of all, the first reason was that to get to the top, you have to work 80 hours a week, and women have children, they're not willing to work that hard.
Okay.
And I can understand where he's coming from on that, of course. But, you know, as a person who likes to work 80 hours a week and has done so, and I know a lot of women who do, it was a little bit concerning. And it was also, of course, concerning because it's kind of a backwards-looking view of the situation.
Didn't really apply to you or to a number of women that you know.
It doesn't, but it also, I think, is something which is changing and so forth. So it was an odd thing to hear it stated. It's been an explanation in the past, and it's certainly an issue. So I could understand it, although I was a little concerned by the way he spoke about it. But it was the second one. It was this thing about aptitude that upset me very much.
And here, talking about biological differences between the sexes as a potential explanation for why women are not as prominent in science and engineering, or as you interpreted it, in the professions more broadly.
Right. I thought, sure, he was talking about professions more broadly. Well, he said, for example, take math and physics. It is part, you know, if you look at a distribution of abilities, we're interested only in the people out at the extreme end of the ability spectrum. And so it is possible that the curves for men and women overlap but aren't exactly the same.
Here you're paraphrasing Larry Summers, President Summers.
Right, that's what he was saying.
Now, he's quoted as having cited research showing that more high school boys than girls tend to score at very high or very low levels on standardized math tests, and that it's important to consider that such differences might stem from biological differences. What's your overall response to that?
Well, I think what concerns me deeply is that there's really compelling research from social psychologists, social sciences, and psychology, that really convincing research demonstrating that unconscious and unintentional bias plays a significant role in these kinds of things, including, you know, how we judge people in terms of merit, and also it can affect even people's performance in the classroom or in the workplace. And that is research is some being done at Harvard, some, you know, but being done in many places, is really important. And so since we know that's true, why would we turn to looking for genetic explanations, which we really can't understand yet, in my opinion? I don't know of any research that can easily at this point sort this out and distinguish the, you know. So to turn to genetic reasons to explain the differences between groups of people and to promote the idea to undergraduates that if you're a woman, forget about achieving at the highest levels. You know, it's not likely that you will.
You had a very visceral response to this, Professor Hopkins. You told the New York Times you couldn't breathe. That kind of bias makes you physically ill. You told the Boston Globe you had to walk out. You would have either blacked out or thrown up if you had stayed. What is it in your experience and your perspective on the world that made your personal reaction so deeply visceral?
I think it's always had something of that effect. I think having spent so many years now studying this problem and seeing the incredibly painful, negative, destructive effects on women and minorities in terms of being undervalued for equal merit is just, you know the pain that this causes and the damage it can do.
You're a prominent DNA researcher. Do you believe that there is any difference biologically, in evolutionary terms, any difference in the fundamental aptitude of males and females for science and engineering?
I believe we do not know the answer to that question, but I have seen no evidence to date. I've had spectacular female students, spectacular male students in equal numbers over my 30 years of teaching. So I've seen, you know, great accomplishment, a great enormous ability in both sexes. But I simply don't think we have, based on all we know at this time, that we could do that. We could know how much difference in the end there will be. I'm not saying there isn't difference. I just don't think we know how to find out right now. But we do know that from the social sciences how these attitudes that Summers was expressing transmit themselves through the society and impact people's lives in a negative way.
And what is the attitude? How would you articulate the attitude you felt he was expressing?
Well, he's not just another person chit-chatting in a room about, well, here's an interesting idea. That's not what it was. This is a leader of education in America who half of the students at Harvard are women, and these brilliant young people absorb the atmosphere around them, the ideas around them. So it's deeply concerning that this person could transmit to these people the idea that they might be genetically unlikely to achieve at the highest levels.
Nancy Hopkins, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Nancy Hopkins is professor of biology and co-chair of the Council on Faculty Diversity at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She spoke with me from New York. We invited Harvard President Larry Summers on tonight. He declined the invitation. He's pretty busy right now, as you can imagine. Our own Jack Beatty is with us, however, another august individual. Jack, here it is. One academic called this as having provoked, has set off an intellectual tsunami. That's a word that resonates these days, but people are taking it very seriously.
Yeah, you know, there are. We all want to say that anything can be said and thought. I mean, you don't want barriers, you don't want the social inhibitions and so on. Well, you don't want to yell fire in a crowded theater either. But there are some hypotheses that are so far in advance of possible knowledge and for which and that they explain or they purport to explain behavior for which there are volumes of substantiated knowledge that you just have to wonder why raise such a question. They're almost pernicious hypotheses. I mean, it brings to mind Charles Murray and the bell curve and the connection between race and IQ in the 80s. And he said, I'm just doing this to raise the question. Then it came out that as a young man, he had lit a cross on somebody's lawn out in Iowa. Yeah, he was just trying to raise the question, raise the debate. Why debate something when you have so much evidence on the other side? I mean, it's almost irresponsible, I think, to talk in these terms, quite apart from it being insulting and so on. I'm just saying it seems intellectually slack to be going to something like this, for which there can't be, at this point in our knowledge, any ground for saying.
Well, we'll dig right into it. Larry Summers says, is quoted as saying, I certainly believe there's been some move in research away from believing that all these things are shaped only by socialization. Listeners, what do you think? Why in 2005 are we talking about whether women are biologically ill-equipped to excel in math and science? Is this honesty about new insights, or is this a fancy new spin on a very old prejudice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about gender, math, and science, and the uproar over the president of Harvard's suggestion that it's time to ask if women don't have the right stuff to be great in math and science. You can join the conversation tonight. Women scientists, are you intrigued or offended? Parents, do your boys and girls handle trig and physics differently? If they do, is it because of the way you raised them, the way society treats them, or is it perhaps in their genes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Davis, California, is Kimberly Schaman, professor of sociology at the University of California at Davis. She's also co-author of Women in Science, Career Processes and Outcomes, the book and research Lawrence Summers referred to in his provocative remarks. Kimberly Schaman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And we're joined from Great Falls, Virginia, by Catherine Didion, director of the International Network of Women Engineers and Scientists. She's former executive director of the Association for Women in Science, a post she held for 14 years. Catherine Didion, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Kimberly Schaman, first to you. As reported, Harvard President Larry Summers quoted your work in raising this issue, saying perhaps we've got to look at things that aren't a result of socialization, things that are innate. Does your research support or provoke that question?
No, I don't think it does.
What have you found that he might be drawing on?
Well, I think that I certainly would say that he was correct in the research findings that he did cite from our book, but that the conclusions that he draws are very much not supported by our research. So he got the story only half right. So it is true, we do find that there are gender differences in the dispersion of scores on these mathematics achievement tests, standardized mathematics achievement tests, such that the dispersion of the scores among young men, and these are high schoolers, is greater than the dispersion amongst young women. And this leads to an overrepresentation of men in the high end of the distribution. Also, in the low end of the distribution, men are overrepresented. So he didn't miscite the research. But in our book and in our research, we go on to ask the question, well, if there is this gender difference, does it help explain later differences in participation in science and engineering education? And we find sound evidence that says that no, it doesn't. It turns out that attaining a high score on one of these mathematics achievement tests is not a good indicator for who goes on to participate in science and engineering majors during the post-secondary education years in college and in university.
Then what's your explanation for why women are so underrepresented in the highest reaches of academic positions in science, engineering, math?
Well, our answer would be that it's a whole bunch of different reasons, and that we have to recognize that the process of becoming a scientist or an engineer, really the process of attaining attaining placement or building a career in any field, is a very long social process that starts with education in high school or even before that, and education in college, and then transitions into the labor force, and that there are many, many influences along the way, influences that have to do with the individual person, and influences that have to do with the people who affect the career choices, affect the career processes of individuals, and also characteristics of the institutions which we have to participate in and interact with to attain or to build a career.
So, Professor, how did it feel to have such a prominent academic figure citing your research to say that there's been a move away from believing that these things are shaped only by socialization?
Well, I was disappointed because it seemed that he only had read a small part of our book, because our book clearly we attempt to look at the whole process of building a career in science and engineering, and a main primary conclusion of our book is that it is a very complex process, and there are many, many influences that operate at specific points in this trajectory, operate to disadvantage women, to make it so that women are less likely to participate and perform at the highest reaches in this career trajectory. So it was disappointing that a person of such stature was, it seemed to me, really only telling half of the story, and telling the half of the story that's not the important part.
Catherine Didion in Virginia, director of the International Network of Women Engineers and Scientists, How do you interpret what went on last Friday and the response to it? What's your big view of this?
Well, I think that it's important that we're having these discussions. I mean, I think at some point we want to get beyond what President Sumner said. I mean, I think it's constructive that we're talking about this, but I think we should be looking at how do we encourage more men and women to go into science and engineering overall. And I think, you know, you could debate whether or not there are gender differences in terms of tests and other measurements. But the question isn't so much are there differences, but do these differences actually make a difference in who participates in science and technology and engineering?
Well, so you say, but I don't think we can skip ahead quite that quickly. The bell has been rung here in a big way on this theme. Denise Denton, Chancellor Designate at the University of California, Santa Cruz, saying this is creating an intellectual tsunami. I understand what you're saying. Let's look at how to address it. But why do you think it's even come up now in 2005? Is Larry Summers correct that there's a move away from seeing socialization, the way girls and boys are socialized in our society, as the reason for this, or the way college students or even young academics are treated socially? Is there a move toward looking at genetics, at what's innate, at biology?
I think there are lots of debates on this right now, but I think part of what you're finding is that, you know, there's a discussion, one, about ability in terms of testing, but there's a whole other discussion, which actually was the focus of the conference in terms of workforce and participation. Actually, there are many good men and women who test well who choose not to participate in science and engineering as a career. So I think part of what we have to look at, again, is not only, you know, are these potential good scientists in terms of their test scores, but how do we actually encourage them? And that's why I'm saying I think it needs to be a more thoughtful discussion, because you could get, let's say, for instance, more of one part of the population testing extremely well, but if they choose not to enter those fields, does that really help you?
A lot of outrage over the comments last week. Do you think it's justified?
I think that the interpretations from around the table, I too was present at the conversation, were such that I would make two comments about them. I mean, I think that, in my opinion, Nancy Hopkins did what she had to do to leave the room. I think there's been a lot made about how she did it. I think she did it as discreetly as she could, and who are we to judge whether or not... I mean, if she said she had to leave the room, we have to respect that. And I think that there's been a lot of criticism given on her that's unfair. At the same time, I will make a comment that talking among my colleagues who were present there, that there does seem to be a kind of a gender breakout, not completely, but to a certain extent, in terms of how his remarks were interpreted. So it wasn't only what he said, but the interpretation of how they were given. And I think part of that was, yes, he did say he was going to be provocative. Yes, he did say he wanted to throw out some issues. But I think it goes back to his idea where with Harvard being in the preeminence it has in terms of educational leadership throughout the country, how one interprets those remarks.
We see even from across the pond in the U.K., the Independent newspaper quoting the director of the Royal Institution of Great Britain, Susan Greenfield, calling the remarks crass and simplistic. So they get interpreted very far afield. I want to hear a bit of tape here. Larry Summers, Harvard President Lawrence Summers, did have his supporters, including famed Harvard psychology and linguistics professor Steven Pinker. Pinker's author of many books on human cognition, including How the Mind Works and The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. In an interview earlier today, he said that Summers' statement was misinterpreted in an example of politics stepping over science.
Many people, even scientists, lose the ability to think in statistical or probabilistic terms when it comes to emotionally and politically charged issues like gender and academia. So what starts out as a statistical hypothesis that on average men and women differ in various traits gets translated into a categorical statement: every last man is better than every last woman in spatial ability, or every last woman is better than every last man in verbal fluency. And we know that those are patently false. There are thousands of professional men who are more fluent than a number of women, and thousands of professional women who are better at spatial abilities than the average man. But people are so ready to be outraged that they stop listening and convert these hypotheses into an extreme and untenable form.
Harvard psychologist and linguistics professor Steven Pinker. I'm joined now on the line from Winthrop, Massachusetts by Carol Rivers. She's a professor of journalism at Boston University, co-author of Same Difference, How Gender Myths Are Hurting Our Relationships, Our Children, and Our Jobs. Carol Rivers, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So on the one hand, we're hearing people in an uproar over Larry Summers' comments saying, you know, this is a throwback, this is out of date, this is not the way that such a high-profile academic leader should be speaking about gender. On the other, we're hearing Steven Pinker just now saying it's easy to get overwrought about this. There's a conversation to be had. How did you hear it? How do you see it, Carol?
Oh, I think what Larry Pinker says is hogwash.
Steven Pinker, you mean? Or
Steven Pinker, I'm sorry, says is hogwash. What's really happening is it's just as if Larry Summers has stood up and said, gee, blacks are dumb. We've really got to reconsider this. That's the kind of impact it has, because we know that girls start to doubt their abilities in math at fifth grade. In third grade, boys and girls like math equally. By fifth grade, girls are starting to not like math, to feel they aren't good at it. In fact, one study in 2004 showed that among third and fourth graders, the teachers and parents of these kids thought that girls were worse at math than boys, even though they saw the very test of the kids they were teaching and whose parents they were showed no gender difference. And the worst thing was that as a result of that, the girls picked up on these attitudes and their math achievement declined. So, you know, Larry Summers should certainly know of the research showing that there is tremendous impact of this idea. If you tell people they can't do something, they'll believe it. And I think it's incredibly naive of people to say, oh, this is just a harmless little comment. It's a very pernicious comment, and it's a dumb comment because it's not true.
But he's saying or said last week he's suggesting there's a new movement to look at biological differences beyond socialization. These things, you know, that's kind of old-fashioned, and you've got to consider what's innate.
Well, nobody denies that there are some biological differences. There's differences between blacks and Asians and whites and women. But, you know, when you look at groups, a lot of the differences don't matter much. For example, the best evidence, I've just looked at a lot of it for our book, when you take the good tests, the tests that are done well, for example, 4 million test scores of boys and girls, there's hardly a tad of difference in those scores. Now, some smaller studies, some other studies will show more boys at the high ends and more girls at the low ends, but the best tests don't. And then just recently there was another big study of 20,000 kids, and the researchers thought that maybe male hormones are what's making boys do well. So they expected to find at around puberty that boys and girls, you know, scores would change. They did not. The trajectories were exactly equal. So when you look at the best research, Diane Halpern, president of the American Psychological Society, did a study of just those areas where there should be gender differences. Guess what? She found boys were far, and girls were far more alike than different. So there's an overwhelming body of research out there that says that what Summers said is old hat, isn't true, and he should have known that.
And yet, there it is, and you say it has an impact. I want to turn to our callers. Don is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hiya.
Hi.
I wanted to mention something that I think is has been validated by an awful lot of tests.
Let's hear it.
And it's something that Mr. Pinker mentioned, and that is, in general, high testosterone levels are correlated with good spatial relationship ability, and in general, low testosterone levels, high female hormone levels in general, are correlated with really good linguistic ability.
And are you saying that spatial ability is a prerequisite for top scientific endeavor?
No, I'm saying that Western European science, which is a men's club, was done by a bunch of guys who had incredibly good spatial relations feelings.
Yeah, but that's
and so it developed as a science of spatial relations, okay? And the women who were good at it tended to be good in algebraic fields that didn't use a lot of the sort of spatial intuitions that the men mathematicians used.
John, hold the thought there. Kimberly Shaman, Catherine Didion, who's wanting to respond there right here?
I would like to respond to that because, you know, if we look at any point in the life course after some say, age 5 or 6, you're going to see differences in hormone levels between boys and girls, and you're going to see differences in outcomes that we might measure. Whether or not those are causal, whether or not those differences in some outcomes, for instance, interest in math or math achievement, are caused by the biological differences or the hormonal differences, is a huge logical leap. To say that that's causal is a huge logical leap, because we have that many years, if you're measuring people at age 5, 10, 12, you have that many years of socialization and participation in a gendered society also. I think that the best brain scientists, the best biological scientists at this point would concede that there, and I would concede as a social scientist, there are biological differences. But these interact with a social world.
But our caller Don says, Kimberly Shaman, a European science is a men's club because it's kind of based on spatial ability.
Oh, but let me jump in here. This is Carol Rivers.
Carol Rivers, yes, please.
You can make a hypothesis, though. People who have a sophisticated view of testosterone say that the research on testosterone is very confusing and non-conclusive. But let's put it this way. Look at Mia Hamm. Look at Serena Williams. They don't have any problem with hand-eye coordination.
I guess 30
years ago, you would have not found a Mia Hamm or a Serena Williams because girls didn't play with balls. So the question is, were boys doing so much better in spatial abilities because of testosterone, or are they doing so much better in spatial abilities because they start throwing the ball at 3 years old?
So get them in the lab and see what happens.
Well, get past Title IX, and voila, look what happens. An explosion of female athletes whose talent depends on spatial ability.
Jack Beatty, this seems to go to the point you were raising earlier, that, give people the experience. Let them be free to pursue, and they will.
Yes, I mean, our society just abounds with examples of that. And, you know, earlier, Professor Pinker was saying that people, quote, lose the ability to think. When wise men talk about statistical patterns, we lose the ability to think because
you get all upset and bothered.
All upset and bothered. Well, the reason is that whole idea, you know, who's losing the ability to think? Summers jumps completely over what's called the social. There's a whole world between the individual and his genes.
Well,
and that's
I don't know if that's fair. He doesn't jump completely over it. He said, look.
Well, that was one of the. Okay, it's true. He did concede that was one of the problems.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So is there no room for discussion of the biological, or are you agreeing with our guest that it just doesn't add up to a real impediment?
I can't concede that it does. And again, it just seems so far in advance. I mean, if you apply Occam's razor to the notion of all this, why don't women do better in these things? You'll never come to the genes. There's so many parsimonious explanations before you get to this.
In between, that are much more about socialization. We're talking about gender, math, and science, and the uproar over the president of Harvard's suggestion that it's time to ask women if women don't have the right stuff to be great. Catherine Didion, director of the International Network of Women Engineers and Science, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Listeners, you
can join us in a world of Marie Curie on radiology, Rosalind Franklin on DNA, Barbara McClintock on the genome. Why are we talking about this? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about gender, math, and science, and the uproar over the president of Harvard's suggestion that it's time to ask if women don't have the right stuff to be great. You can join the conversation tonight should Harvard President Larry Summers be applauded for raising this issue, or is this a failure of academic leadership? And what is it in our national dialogue that's brought us back to issues like this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Kimberly Shaman, a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, and co-author of Women in Science, Career Processes and Outcomes, the research that Larry Summers cited in his remarks last week. She says he got it wrong. Carol Rivers is joining us. She's professor of journalism at Boston University and co-author of Same Difference, How Gender Myths Are Hurting Our Relationships, Our Children, and Our Jobs. Nina is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I'm actually a real live Harvard female sciences PhD student.
No kidding. How did you do that?
You know what? I was never told that I couldn't. And I think that that's a common experience of most of the women that I know that are in sciences.
They were lucky enough not to be told that they couldn't.
I don't think I was ever told that I shouldn't or could not do science. And actually, in my program at the Harvard Medical School in molecular biology, I believe that There's actually a majority of female students.
So when you read or heard Larry Summers' remarks on women's socialization and what's innate, did you feel you were being told by a prominent academic president of your university that, in fact, you couldn't?
No, I think ultimately I'm kind of unconcerned about the view that he's expressing because I know too many women who are in science right now and who are excelling at it. I've never stopped to ponder whether or not it's impossible for me to continue because I've been too busy actually working in science and being good at it.
So why so few women tenured at Harvard in this field and many other universities? Why so few? There are many, but nevertheless, relatively few at top positions in the scientific community.
It's been obvious to me since I think probably the age of 17 that it is social factors. It's very clearly an old boys' network. It's based on a number of factors that I think are not. I think the culture is changing. I know at least one male faculty member here at Harvard who moved from academia to industry because it was a job that allowed him to actually see his children every night for dinner. And I think there are issues like that that make a big effect and make the numbers drop off after graduate school in terms of how many women stay on.
Nina, let me ask you something. You're a molecular biologist. That's a very very spatially oriented at the final level, I guess. We're hearing tonight that perhaps males have greater spatial ability, women linguistic ability. Do you find yourself approaching science in a way that you perceive as different from male colleagues? Is it insulting to you to hear your gender cited as having less spatial ability? Is it a handicap? Is it irrelevant?
I think it's totally irrelevant. I think the one difference between perhaps me and some of my male colleagues is the way I present myself.
Exactly. You need to communicate.
Meaning the way that it's all a question of PR, really, and of tooting your own horn a little louder than everyone else in the room. And I think that's the fundamental ethos of science. I don't think that my innate abilities are any different.
Other skills.
Nina, we've got it loud and clear. Thank you very much for your call. Let's get another call here. Angelica is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Angelica. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually quite open to the idea that there might be differences, not necessarily in aptitude, but very often in how women or men approach a problem.
And that's good.
But I think the problem really is that we're stopping short of the conclusion. And what women really need is more encouragement on capitalizing on their strengths.
Stopping short of what conclusion, Angelica?
Well, I think it's not enough to just point out here are the differences. I think you have to go the step further and say, well, these are the strengths women bring to the table, and they should be more confident in capitalizing on them.
Are you in science yourself, Angelica?
Yeah, I'm a chemist, actually. I'm a PhD chemist, and I've been in the very male-dominated chemistry department at Harvard for a postdoc.
So did you hear Larry Summers is trying to open the conversation to just that further extent that you're asking for, or something else?
You know, to some degree, just having the conversation tonight is already one step that I find actually quite interesting. And I'm in industry now, and I see women, very, very smart women scientists being tremendous project managers. They have different abilities to build teams around science and to approach problems in a less competitive way, but in a more team-building way. And I think if women get a little bit more confident in applying that in academia too, I think they could thrive quite a bit. And I think the problem is that women don't tend to do that.
Angelica, thank you so much for that call. Carol Rivers, let me put that to you. Let's give Larry Summers the benefit of the doubt for a moment. Maybe he was trying to open the door to exactly that kind of conversation, to say, well, maybe the approaches are different, and so let's talk about them and see if we can't define the strengths of each. Is that in itself an offensive notion?
But that wasn't what he said. He said that basically the thrust of his thesis was that women didn't have the right stuff any way you toss it. Certainly nobody's closed to the idea that men and women may bring different skills and abilities to the table, but although I would argue that to slice it up just by men and women is really too small, because there are many men who are terrific at communication. Men are just as good as verbal abilities. And it's almost sort of silly to start dividing up men and women, because it doesn't make sense. Individuals are there's so much overlap between men and women.
You're back to that crude, simplistic characterization that we heard from London in the Independent newspaper here.
Oh, exactly. The very simplistic and crude and reductionist. You know, it's like, oh, your car doesn't work, let's look at the battery, you know. You simply can't say gender doesn't explain much of anything. If you look at a woman, the likelihood that she's going to be good or bad at math is no better than chance.
No better than chance. Let me get another call here. Joanna's calling from New York City. Hi, Joanna. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, so I worked at the National Institute of Health similar to a caller before doing molecular biology, actually neuromolecular biology.
That makes you a scientist, I'd say.
Yeah, and I very much found it to be a boys' club. I was in the minority being a female, and I think the reason why he's saying these things is because gender bias is still very much a thing. It's very much prevalent in today's society. It's just like racism. It's this underlying factor that's going on.
And you're seeing it in his comments, in his perspective on the world.
Yeah, definitely. And it is a boys' club. There are men up at the top, and it really swayed me away. I'm actually now a student in social work. I couldn't find it welcoming at all.
Wow, out of neurobiology and into social work. So when Larry Summers says, you know, suggests, I don't know how to reduce it, but, you know, that maybe women don't have the right stuff, do you see the men, the kind of men you worked with, as saying, well, maybe they don't, and we don't really want them here?
Well, a lot of the men don't have it either.
Yeah. It's not a welcoming field right now. It's frustrating. It's really frustrating.
We hear it. And the NIH has just lost a scientist from New York who's gone, a woman who's gone to social science. Joanna, thanks for your call. Kimberly Shaman, I hear you there.
Oh, okay. I just want to point out let's take another perspective on this. We're talking about how the gender differences between men and women his proposition is that this gender difference in math achievement can explain later gender differences in representation. It's just such a simplistic, very naive proposition. Let's look at it from the other perspective. What does it take to be a good scientist? Is achievement on standardized mathematics tests the only thing that is our good indicator of who's going to become a scientist? No, there's lots of different traits that are required, and some of those have already been mentioned by some of the women scientists who have called in. Team building, management skills, organization skills, creativity, communication skills, human intuition, ability to think cross-disciplinary lines. All of these things are really required for good, creative, productive scientific research and for good teaching of science.
We hear it. So, Carol Rivers, what do you think it is that has the president of Harvard putting this back on the map here in January of 2005?
Well, politically, it could be that he's got to find a reason that women aren't getting tenured at Harvard. So, you know, politically...
So tar the whole gender?
Makes him look a lot better if he says, oh, it's not that we're discriminating or that we're an old boys club. It's really they haven't got the right stuff. So there could be a political agenda.
Is there a broader social moment that kind of gives him permission to say that? Is there a broader mood at large?
Oh, yes. I think that there's very much a backlash, whether it comes to race or it comes to gender. It is now okay to say things like, maybe black people aren't as smart. Maybe they shouldn't achieve for so much. It's okay to say women shouldn't achieve so much in some areas. We're in a very conservative era. There are people who want these kind of sentiments out there. There are people who do support and believe in male dominance. And, yes, we are in that kind of a political atmosphere, alas.
Larry Summers' letter yesterday saying, my comments have been taken as suggesting that women lack the ability to succeed at the highest levels of math and science. I did not say that, nor do I believe it. And yet, Jack, when a man in his position speaks around this area, I mean, we heard what Steven Pinker said, that it can be magnified, maybe even echoed incorrectly. But, man, it sets off what someone called a tsunami.
And profoundly insulting to the people who are right there at the table. You know, Harvard, of all places, they just had some tremendous tenure fights about women trying to get jobs there in the sociology department. And Summers should know that. He should also know that the history department, up until the day before yesterday, would not appoint anybody to teach modern American history because one of its eminent professors didn't think there was such a subject as modern American history. That's how old boy and you know, ingrown these things can be. And he's pointing to gender, to genetic differences when you have these old, you know, you have fetishes within the disciplines that decide who's given tenure or not. I mean, of all places, Harvard with all these problems with tenure.
Kimberly Shulman, we just got 20 seconds here. Look forward. Do you see women in the next coming decades as very prominent in science in spite of this kind of perspective or the issues that Larry Summers has raised?
I think that academic science in particular has a problem in recruiting and retaining very smart women in all fields, including sciences and engineering. And I see more women finding jobs in industry. Industry seems to be doing a better job at recruiting and retaining and creating work environments which are much more conducive to the work life that women want to have and the type of research that they want to do.
So maybe that's what will happen. I'm afraid we're out of time with that. But Kimberly Shaman at the University of California, Davis, we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Carol Rivers, co-author of Same Difference, professor of journalism at Boston University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, in a moment, the nation's capital prepares for tomorrow's inauguration. This is On Point. Washington, D.C. is busily preparing for President Bush's inauguration tomorrow. Streets have been closed, manhole covers have been welded shut, and miles of steel fencing and concrete barriers have made the nation's capital look like a city under siege. The marching bands are rehearsing on Pennsylvania Avenue. Armies of protesters are plotting their strategies. The president himself has geared up for his big day by crisscrossing the city, speaking to supporters at pre-inaugural parties. Tonight we bring you some sounds and voices from Washington, D.C. as the nation's capital prepares for tomorrow's inauguration.
This is unprecedented when it comes to the level of security that will be in effect for the inauguration and those events that are surrounding it. We are prepared to deal with any eventuality that may present itself to us. And so we're very comfortable now that we're ready to get on with the festivities.
I look forward to soaking in much more of the atmosphere and the environment. It'll be a proud moment. It's a good speech. I'm looking forward to giving it. It speaks to the values and hopes of our country. And I guess the best way to summarize it is, freedom is powerful.
If we are to listen to our president, we're gonna have to bomb ourselves.
This is still America, and if this is supposed to be the celebration of freedom and democracy, our feeling is that free speech and free assembly is part of that democracy, and this is our way to celebrate it.
Our challenge is to see to it that both groups can have their voices heard. The parade goes off without a hitch. The president moves from the Capitol back down to the White House without any problems at all, and we'll be successful. But we will have quite a few protests in the city, and we're going to be challenged quite a bit to keep up with all that.
God bless America, Mr. President, land that you lead. Lord, stand beside him.
We have actually gone to a sign company and are having crosses made. We will be there inaugural morning with crosses to see what the Secret Service does.
Into the storm, into the night. They champion our cause, and they fight our fight.
With the campaign behind us, Americans lift up our sights to the years ahead and to the great goals we will achieve for our country.
Sounds and voices from Washington, D.C., as the nation's capital prepares for tomorrow's inauguration. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.